Well, we have our lesson in chapter 21 and 22 of 1 Samuel. These, of course, are given to us by God because it's through the study of their experiences that we will learn and be able to be ready for experiences that would come our way. David is, of course, a human being and a man after God's own heart. And yet you see he had to go through a life that a lot of it was not charted by him. And the attitudes of others had played a big part in the experiences that he had to contend with. So he's an example of suffering rejection. He's an example of suffering adversity. And of course he had a faith that was solid. And it wasn't just based on emotional things, but it was based on a God that would never forsake him, a God that had chosen him for a duty to do, and he was well aware of that. And, of course, he was well aware of the fact that since God chose him for that duty, that God would be the one to have to put him in that place of service, and he did not try to take it into his own hands. When you look at the circumstances, you look at the conversations, you look at the way things went back and forth, I think you can realize in that our lives are not able to measure up to a perfect standard on everything. And that's why God has to be the judge. And he's the one that can lay the axe to the root of the tree, so to speak. Saul was really the guy responsible for what's going on to a large extent, but so was Israel. Israel had not accepted God's choice of bringing David forward to be their king and of not allowing Saul to go on to be king. Israel had not accepted that. So you see a lot here that's going to happen due to those attitudes that people had. And so you can see the great trouble that unbelief and stubbornness and being in rebellion, how it brings things to pass on a large scale as well as on an individual scale. Now, you and I are living in a time that we are relatively at ease where we're at, spiritually speaking, but we don't have any assurance that we're not going to see difficult times. So I think this is what makes lessons like this so valuable to us, is that we need to observe and we need to see how that things played out, and we can learn from people's mistakes. We can also learn from their wise choices, and we have an advantage they didn't have. David did not have a lot of biblical history that he could study and draw from, but he was pretty well learning all of this on his own as he went forward. And there'll be plenty of that. There'll be plenty of the fact that we have to learn as we go, but we know also that we need to seize upon every bit of information that we can gather from our study of other people's lives. In last week's lesson, we saw where that David and Jonathan had been able to, you might say, feel out Saul and find out that Saul was definitely determined to kill David, and then how that Jonathan and David renewed their covenant. They were wanting to confirm to each other where they stood. They didn't want anything between them. They didn't want even... This was a very difficult situation for Jonathan because Saul was his father. And Jonathan knew, however, that David was God's chosen. So he has to do what he can in support of his father without crossing the line of going against what God has chosen for David. And very difficult path he had to go down. But he assured David that he was going to do what the Lord would have him to do. As you see in verse 42 of chapter 20, Jonathan said to David, Go in peace, for as much as we have sworn both of us in the name of the Lord, saying, The Lord be between me and thee, and between my seed and thy seed forever. And he arose and departed, and Jonathan went into the city. So it's a wonderful thing to stake your claim where God will be the one to determine how the outcome will be. And that's where both of them are at this time. They want God to guide them. And this is a very, very difficult time for them. So David then comes to Nob in verse 1 of chapter 21 to Ahimelech the priest. And Ahimelech was afraid at the meeting of David, said unto him, Why art thou alone and no man with thee? So this was an unusual thing. David was the king's son-in-law. David was the one that really was a prominent person now in Israel. And suddenly he shows up at this priest's door at the house of God, and there's no explanation for it. And so he suspects trouble. He knows something's not right, and he's afraid. And so David, now, when you think about the story that David told, again, remind yourself that these are situations that you cannot get a perfect scenario for them, and you don't justify anything that was done, but you see how this worked out and why David did what he did, and then how that this needs to be dealt with by God on his terms. And you don't find where God ever came up and chastised David and punished him for the way that things went, because basically, this all goes back to Saul and to the rejection of God's plan. So David tells him a story, but this is to protect Ahimelech. And so you can see what you would call extenuating circumstances. And there's a lot of things in life that, you know, you just can't make a home run out of a pitch in the dirt. And so David's in a situation. He realizes Ahimelech's in a situation. So he makes his story up that the king in verse 2 hath commanded me a business and has said unto me, Let no man know anything of the business whereabout I send thee and what I have commanded thee, and I have appointed my servants to such and such a place. So he says, this is such an urgent, top secret mission that nobody knows anything about it, and therefore it's urgent, and that's why I'm here under these circumstances. This again, like I say, is something that David is using his best judgment as to how to go about this. And even though you might say, well, he didn't tell the truth and made up this story, I think it takes an overview to understand what's going on here and not pass judgment against David. There are certainly no new standards being established here that we should follow, but it's revealing why God has to be the judge and not man. God looks on the heart. God sees everything as it really is. And of course, we can look at technicality. And technicality, we could condemn David right here. Oh, he told a lie. Well, so we can use technicality in our favor or against somebody else. But there is still the need for God's judgment in order to get this thing on the right plane it needs to be on. And of course, David is in a place where he could have used all that's going against him as an excuse to not serve God. Well, if this is what I get for serving God, you know, it's just too much. And so he could have decided, I'm going to sidestep this, and I'm not going to go ahead with what God wants me to do. I'm not going to stay on course, but I'm just going to take a step here that's going to kind of get the heat off of me. But God doesn't give us a license for unfaithfulness due to circumstances. He will not allow that because he's able to be with us. He's able to make a way out for us. He's able to bring the right conclusion in the end. So he asked the priest for bread. He said, "Give me 5 loaves of bread." In verse 4, the priest answered David and said, "There is no common bread under mine hand, but there is a hallowed bread. If the young men have kept themselves at least from women." And David answered the priest and said unto him, "Of a truth, women have been kept from us about these 3 days since I came out. And the vessels of the young men are holy, and the bread is in a manner common. Yea, though it were sanctified this day in the vessel." So the priest gave him hallowed bread. Now that's not the way that the hallowed bread was to normally go. Every day they would make hallowed bread. God had a recipe for it. And this bread would then be placed in the house of God. And every day new bread would be placed there. And the old bread taken out. And it was not just to be taken out on the street and given to anybody, but it was to be dealt with in the manner that God said. But in this case, there was a need for food. And so the priest gave him hallowed bread, not the way that it was set up by law, but there was a necessity here. And so the priest gave this to him for a necessary purpose. I want to put with this because, like I say, technicalities here, there's a lot of them that's not being measured up to, but yet God will have to be the judge of it. In Mark chapter 2, and there in verse 23, Mark 2:23, it came to pass that he went through the cornfields on the Sabbath day, and his disciples began as they went to pluck the ears of corn. And the Pharisees said unto him, "Behold, why do they on the Sabbath day that which is not lawful?" So there's a technicality. He said unto them, "Have you never read what David did when he had need and was an hungered? He and they that were with him, how he went into the house of God in the days of Abiathar the high priest and did eat the showbread, which is not lawful to eat but for the priest, and gave also to them which were with him. And he said unto them, The Sabbath was made for man, and not man for the Sabbath. Therefore the Son of Man is Lord also of the Sabbath." In Matthew 12:12, when people were accusing Christ of working on the Sabbath because he healed a guy on the Sabbath day, he said, "It is lawful to do good on the Sabbath day." So there is a technicality that we can use, like I say, use it, and in some cases, it can actually go against what is best if we just go by the technicality. And so in this case, Christ did not condemn David for that, but it was a necessary thing for life and for food. And of course, you know that the Bible also teaches that when they came to the technicality of the Sabbath day, that Christ gave them a lesson. If you have an animal that falls in a ditch on the Sabbath day, you'll pull him out. And so he said, it is lawful to do good. So this is a instance where you kind of have to have an overview here and realize that God will be the one to settle all the dust. But there are times when difficulty is confronting us, and we have to do some things that maybe we're not sure about, but we have to do it, and then we do it prayerfully and hopefully that it'll all work out in God's plan and in God's time. So just observe, that's what we're trying to say. Observe these things and take them into account and know that it does take God to settle everything. You and I cannot do it by just a technicality of law. There are even laws that are written on our books in a way to, just like speed limits. There are speed limits that are for our good, but there are times when necessity requires a person go faster than the speed limit. And so you have to have an overview of that. An ambulance and all, they, you know, sometimes they have to get over the speed limit, a cop. And maybe if you're taking somebody to the hospital and they're bleeding out, you can't always just go by the speed limit. You have to do what you have to do. So there is an overview that's always needed when it comes to just dealing with things strictly by the law. Well, as this all was going down, and David now has a showbread, you notice in verse 7, a certain man of the servants of Saul was there that day detained before the Lord, and his name was Doeg, an Edomite, the chiefest of the herdmen that belonged to Saul. Now that's going to come into play as we go throughout the rest of the lesson. But if you can just think of it this way, here's somebody that the devil is going to use now. And it seemed like that the devil always has a way of getting an inside track on something. And so here is Doeg, who is going to be used of the devil to give a false report. And as a result, many people lose their lives. Now in verse 8, David said unto Ahimelech, "And is there not here under thine hand spear or sword? For I have neither brought my sword nor my weapons with me, because the king's business required haste. And the priest said, the sword of Goliath the Philistine, whom thou slewest in the valley of Elah, behold, it is here wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If thou wilt take that, take it, for there is no other save that here. And David said, there is none like that, give it me." The thought that came to my mind is, how did the sword get there? You know, David had used it to kill Goliath. The normal thing would be for David to take that sword and put it over his mantle. You know, that's my trophy. I killed the giant. David didn't do that. He apparently, how did it get there in the house of God? David had to give it to the house of God. And I think that shows us again, when you go back to the time that he went up against the giant, and he told the giant, he said, "The Lord doesn't save with sword and spear, but the Lord is going to give you into my hand, that everybody will know that the Lord is the one that gives the victory." So I believe David dedicated the sword to the house of God as a testimony. The Lord gave us that victory. And it wasn't me, it was the Lord. But it comes in handy now. And so there's no one who is any more deserving of this sword than what David would be. But just put in the midst of this also, David is wrongfully being pursued, and everything about his situation, he's not at fault. There's so many people here out of line with God. David did not go on a holy war to try to straighten everything out himself. I know years ago there was things going on in the church, and the pastor referred to a number of times that there were a few people in the church who had made themselves self-appointed police force. And they were going about visiting people and trying to get everybody in their way of line. And so as a result, they were just stirring up more trouble rather than calming anything down. So David would have rooted up a lot of wheat with the tares if he had tried to take this into his own hands. If he would have said, "Well, God has anointed me to be king. Saul shouldn't be king. So let's go and let's get this thing straightened out." It would have really been a mess, a lot of bloodshed. So he's waiting on God. Now, that's an important lesson in life. It's one that sometimes is very difficult to really get through to us, but we have to get it in that category to where it's in God's hands. Well, you notice now that David arose and fled that day in verse 10 for fear of Saul and went to Achish, the king of Gath. Now, you don't have any instruction from God here to David to do that, but David is doing what he feels he's got to do. So again, I say, this is something you have to have an overview here and just follow how that God protected David in these times when it was so confusing. But in verse 11, the servants of Achish said unto him, is not this David the king of the land? Now think about that. Israel knows that David's been anointed king. Samuel knows it. Saul knows it. But they won't accept it. But the enemy says, David's the king of Israel. But Israel is just not coming around on that. So they say, did they not sing one to another of him in dances, saying, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s? And David laid up these words in his heart and was sore afraid of Achish, the king of Gath. Well, think about that a moment. If Achish was to begin to think about, this is the guy that killed my strongest soldier I had, this is the guy that caused my army to lose a battle, lose a war, so I need to really string him up. So that's what's coming to David's mind. All right, they perhaps are going to come after me now. In verse 13, he changed his behavior before them and feigned himself mad in their hands, scrabbled on the doors of the gate and let his spittle fall down upon his beard. Then said Achish unto his servants, lo, ye see the man is mad. Wherefore then have ye brought him to me? Have I need of madmen that ye have brought this fellow to play the madman in my presence? Shall this fellow come into my house? So what happens? He's able to get out of this jam. Not because everything is picture perfect, but because David is wanting to do what's right, but he's thrown so many foul balls. I thought about how that David now is in this place where he escapes. He escapes, as you'll see in verse 1 of chapter 22. It's kind of like what happened to Abraham in the 12th chapter of Genesis when Abraham went down to Egypt, and it happened twice with Abraham, one with Abimelech and one with Pharaoh. And because of fear, he said, Sarah is my sister. And she was his half-sister. But he didn't tell the truth that she was his wife. So both of these men, Pharaoh and Abimelech, I think it was Abimelech, anyway, they brought Sarah into their castles to make her their wife, and God intervened. And both times, it turned out to be a shameful thing for Abraham, but God delivered him. And God brought Abraham through it all. So I think you can see that we don't always have a perfect life, a perfect plan, a perfect response to our circumstances. But God was looking on David's heart, and God knew that David's situation, God being his judge. So rather than let these things that are so difficult to deal with and these things that are so off the chart, let them be that which would catch David, God always saw to it that David got out of it, that he was able to escape. And that's the marvelous ability of God to take the tangledness of our lives and how it can be so deeply entwined with so many different things. And yet if our heart's right with him, he'll bring us through it. And just observe. I mean, it's just a beautiful picture when you see the outcome of how that God brought David through it all. So he escapes to the cave of Adullam in verse 1. And when his brethren and all his father's house heard it, they went down thither to him. And we know what that's about. Saul is out to get David. Saul will use any means he can to get David. And that means David's family is in jeopardy. Saul might use them as hostages, or he might just out of his anger go kill them because they are David's relatives. So for their safety's sake, they now go down to David. And then in verse 2, everyone that was in distress, everyone that was in debt, and everyone that was discontented gathered themselves unto him, and he became a captain over them, and there were with him about 400 men. Now, as you follow that group of people forward, there were some of them that were pretty far out, because I think when it comes to chapter 30, you will see that there were some of them who really didn't have right interest, and there were others that did. But amongst this group, there were some mighty men, some great men in there. And that can be seen in chapter 23 of 2 Samuel. Some of these people were very good people, but there's hard times in Israel now. And people that were in hard times and suffering under Saul, they decide it's to our best interest to go with David. And not only probably circumstances, but I'm sure there were some people that went with David because they knew God had anointed him to be king. In verse 3, David went thence to Mizpah of Moab, and he said unto the king of Moab, "Let my father and my mother, I pray thee, come forth and be with you till I know what God will do for me." And he brought them before the king of Moab, and they dwelt with him all the while that David was in the hold. So he seeks some place, some safe house, you might say, for his family, and he goes to Moab. Now, if you think about Moab, yeah, they're not a nation that is of God, but David's great-grandmother was from Moab, and that's Ruth. And I'm not saying that's necessarily the reason why he went there, but apparently there were some terms that would allow him to think that I can take my family there, and they will be kept under safeguard. And probably the king of Moab wasn't on good terms with King Saul either. So that would give that as an opportunity for that. But the point in verse 3 that needs to be brought out, he said, "Be with you till I know what God will do for me." So he's doing the best he knows to do, but he's saying, "My hope is still in God. And I want to know what God's will be and how God will unfold for me." And right now, he said, "I don't really know." But he said, "I know it's coming. I know God will make a way." So none of this is David relying upon his ability to be perfect. None of it is his perfection, but he's relying upon God, that God's going to be the one that's going to have to get me through this. In verse 5, you see that God responds. "The prophet Gad said unto David, Abide not in the hold. Depart and get thee into the land of Judah. Then David departed and came into the forest of Horeth." Now that's a more dangerous place than just to abide in the hold. But you can see that David was always willing to accept what God told him through his prophets. He was willing to honor that. And he was to lift his hand up to the Lord. He was to abide in Israel. He was not to seek refuge. He was not to go into hiding, but he was to keep himself out there to where God could use him, because a lot of work had to be done in Israel to bring it around to where David would be king and Saul would be removed. So the Lord is going to continue to use David. This will be for Saul's exposure, and it will also be for Israel's recognition of that which they have been very slow to recognize. But through it all, David had to endure. This is a hard time. If you can think about having to flee, as it was brought out last night in men's meeting, David's marriage was ruined by this. Michal loved David, and yet she had to help him escape, and so therefore that was the end of their marriage. So he lost his wife, he lost his home, he's the most wanted man in Israel, and he has to endure. In 1 Peter chapter 1, you know, we may not have this at all in any view in any of our experiences that we think we'll encounter. That's why we need to observe. In 1 Peter chapter 1, and there in verse 6 and 7, it says, "Wherein ye greatly rejoice, so now for a season, if need be, ye are in heaviness through manifold temptations, that the trial of your faith, being much more precious than of gold that perisheth, though it be tried with fire, might be found unto praise and honor and glory at the appearing of Jesus Christ. You ever had a trial of faith? You ever had a trial that seemed like you were burning? Well, those come to us. But during that time, which seems like, I don't know whether I can get through this or not, those are the times when we remain faithful to God that we're laying up treasure in heaven, because God's honoring the faith that we are putting forth in doing that. Back to our lesson again. Saul now gets word that David is back in Judah. And so he has a little meeting with his staff, with his people that are around him. And in verse 7, Saul said unto his servants that stood about him, "Hear now, ye Benjamites, will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards, and make you all captains of thousands and captains of hundreds? That all of you have conspired against me, and there is none that showeth me that my son hath made a league with the son of Jesse, and there is none of you that is sorry for me, or showeth unto me that my son hath stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as at this day." The evil spirit is upon Saul. The spirit of God is not with him. So you see, his thinking is always going in the wrong direction. He accuses and makes out like David is a traitor. And you all know he's a traitor. And even my son has made a league with him. And yet nobody is really acknowledging that. Nobody is talking to me about it, that I'm the poor victim and David is a traitor. And do you think that if David is king, that you're going to be better off than you are now? So he really lays it out. He plays on their minds. He's warring against David through the minds of his people now. And you and I know that a lot of things are just decided there. When somebody puts something in somebody's mind, well, that's it. And so it all sounds legitimate, but it's not. Saul's the problem, not David. David's not the traitor. This whole scenario has been brought about by Saul's refusal to obey God. But he makes out as if David is out to destroy him. And here he's the one trying to destroy David. So these are things to, again, observe. And these are things that we have to take into account as we see the circumstances unfold. Here comes Doeg now in verse 9, the Edomite. And he said in verse 9, "I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, and he inquired of the Lord for him." Now, that's a lie. Now, if you go back, the priest did not inquire of the Lord. So he makes it out like Ahimelech was all in for David, and he was praying for David, and he gave him food and gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine. So that looks like it's a pretty solid case against Ahimelech. The king then calls for Ahimelech, as you see in verse 11, and for all the priests at Nob. And they came to the king. And so the king now accuses them of conspiracy against him in verse 13. "Why have ye conspired against me, thou and the son of Jesse, and that thou hast given him bread and a sword, and hast inquired of God for him, that he should rise against me to lie in wait as at this day?" So that case can be made if you don't bring in the real facts and the real truth. And so the picture is being painted now that David is trying to overthrow Saul, and Ahimelech is now his supporter and his spiritual promoter. Well, the priest in verse 14, "Ahimelech answered the king and said, and who is so faithful among all thy servants as David?" Remember, every time it referred to David in his service to Saul, that he behaved himself wisely And his name was much set by because he behaved himself so wisely. So Ahimelech says, this is a fact that you've had him as your most faithful servant. He's also your son-in-law. That'll account for something. And goeth at thy bidding and is honorable in thy house. Did I then begin to inquire of God for him? Be it far from me. In other words, I didn't do that. That's not what I did. Let not the king impute anything unto his servant, nor to all the house of my father. For thy servant knew nothing of this, less or more. Now that was the truth. He told the truth. The king said, thou shalt surely die, Ahimelech, thou and all thy father's house. So you see, the truth doesn't matter now because of the way things are working in Saul's heart and mind. And anything that would be a compliment to David or anything that would be to exonerate David from wrongdoing, Saul can't bear to hear those words. Those are words that when Ahimelech said he's a faithful servant, he couldn't bear to hear that. So he orders their death in verse 16. Anybody who would not turn against David was marked by Saul to be his enemy. That's the way it was going down with Saul. Saul was going to make an example of these priests to send a message to all of Israel. Anybody who's sympathetic to David, anybody who even gives a loaf of bread to David, anybody who even perhaps tips her hat to David, why, they're going to die. They better not in any way help David. What do you have? A manifestation of the wickedness of stubbornness and rebellion. God said through Samuel back in chapter 15 that stubbornness and rebellion is as a sin of witchcraft and idolatry. This is just as wicked as witchcraft. Now, due to the fear of God, the king said unto the footman that stood by him, turn and slay the priest of the Lord, because their hand also was with David, because they knew when he fled and did not show it me, but the servants of the king would not put forth their hand to fall upon the priest of the Lord. But Doeg would. You know, he's an opportunist. He's thinking that he's really going to advance himself now in Saul's kingdom. So the king said to Doeg, turn thou and fall upon the priest. And Doeg, the Edomite, turned and he fell upon the priest and slew on that day 85 persons that did wear a linen ephod. And Nob, the city of the priest, smote he with the edge of the sword, both men and women, children and sucklings, and oxen and asses and sheep with the edge of the sword. Somebody says, well, they were God's priests. Why didn't God step in? They were also of the household of Eli. And God had told Eli back in the very beginning that he was going to remove all of his household from the priesthood because it had become so wicked that he could no longer use them. So God permits their deaths. He does not step in because the judgment had already been pronounced by God that they will no longer be a family of priests in Israel. So they were not being used of God. Therefore, God was not going to be their defender. But Ahimelech, one of the sons of Ahimelech, which is Abiathar, escaped and came and fled after David and showed David. And so David said in verse 22 unto Abiathar, I knew it that day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would surely tell Saul, I have occasioned the death of all the persons of thy father's house. Abide thou with me, fear not, for he that seeketh my life seeketh thy life, but with me thou shalt be in safeguard. So that's just the way David said, I knew it was going to happen because of Doeg and knowing what kind of a man he was. David had made the Lord his refuge, and he knew God would take care of him, so he recommended anybody that would stay with him would also share in that refuge. I want to leave you with a verse in Acts 14:22. confirming the souls of the disciples and exhorting them to continue in the faith, and that we must, through much tribulation, enter into the kingdom of God. The saints, and we're reading about that in the book of Acts, and that was the beginning of the work of the Lord in the New Testament church age, and boy, did they have a rough time. They had a rough time. Thank God for what you have. We are living in a time that perhaps we don't even think about it, but we ought to. But observe these lessons, because we know what's coming with the coming of Antichrist and how that everything is being stacked against Christians right now. It's being stacked against Christians right now, and we're beginning to feel it. But this is just the beginning of what we know the Bible says. So we need to gear up our faith and not get distracted, like Christ warned about in Luke 21, of the whole generation completely getting distracted by everything involved in this life and all the pleasures, to where that it just catches everybody in a snare.